Welcome to Cross Defense, that show where we do nothing but talk about apologetics. It's an ever-increasing topic of interest to Christians of all ages, especially younger people. They want to know what's behind some of the things that Christians have always believed. Serious intellectual questions, and we shouldn't just blow them off. So we should bring our heads together with Jesus and reason about these things, and that's the goal of apologetics. That's the purpose and the goal of this program on apologetics we call Cross Defense. I'm your host, Rod Zwanzer, broadcasting live today from the studio complex of Worldwide KFUO at the International Center of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, Kirkwood, St. Louis, USA. Our guest today is a professor philosophy and other things. We'll ask him more about that in a minute at Concordia University, Irvine, California. And his name is Daniel Dean. Dan, welcome to Cross Defense.
How you doing there, Rod? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, it's great having you on. And Dan, tell us a little bit about what you teach there at Irvine, what some of your interests are, so the guests can have a feel for where you're coming from. And I know you're coming from a good place.
Sure, yeah. I'm a professor of philosophy out here at Concordia University, Irvine, and I head up the core philosophy sections from our kind of core curriculum, which is kind of a classic great books program we have for all freshmen and sophomores, actually, that come through Concordia University, Irvine.
Boy, that sounds fun. I wish we had that one online.
Yeah.
That'd be fun, wouldn't it? A lot of people out here, including me, would probably want to take that just to brush up a little, huh?
You know, I think there's move to put some rendition of the course up online as well. So maybe in the near future, you'll get your wish.
Oh, great. I would promote that even free for you guys.
Great. I'll let them know.
Excellent. And today we're talking about an article that I take it is just one installment on a series on this, and it's on 1517, the Legacy Project, 1517legacy.com, and you wrote an article there called Beavers Help with Apologetics, Formal Debate, Jailbreak. Now, I love all that, because so people aren't clicking off their radios or their computers here. This is a fun way to make an important apologetics point. And you do so with an interesting, it's a mammal, isn't it? A beaver?
Beaver. It's a mammal, and it's of the rodent class. The idea behind it. I mean, you know, one of the things I do. Philosophers are we're kind of weird people, right? I mean,
what does a philosopher do anyway?
Well, we sit and think.
Ah, yeah, right. Yeah. Some people get all the good jobs.
Right, and we have too much time to do that. So I'm sitting here trying to write an article for 1517, and my kid is bringing home books from the library on beavers, and I'm reading up on beavers, and they're absolutely fascinating creatures. But then I start thinking, I go, I wonder what else there is out there on beavers, and what I learned from my son was that these beavers, you know, they radically change the environments they're in. And I started thinking, you know, me as the adult going, well, man, I'd hate to have my property next to a place where there's beavers.
Yeah.
So I started doing some searching, and I found these actual beaver management manuals that various governments have put out. St. Louis, I looked at Missouri, they actually have a website that they talk about beaver problems in the great state of Missouri. So you guys, your listeners, can go have fun figuring out what you guys have decided to do with your beavers.
They are neat. You know, I checked one out, and it was fascinating. Some college, I think student, maybe even graduate, was doing a project on beavers, and she was tracking the water flow with all kinds of sophisticated thing, you know, looking at how much rainfall and then how much they increase the size of the dam and the water coming in, water going out. It was like fascinating. And she said that every time she would go and bust the dams for various purposes, just fascinating stuff. So this kind of inspired you to find it useful for apologetics.
Yeah. I mean, because I noticed, you know, as I started reading through, and I didn't read many of them, but the two that I post in the blog post, the two government manuals, I realized what a disconnect there is between the government manual discussion of the beaver and my child's, like, you know, elementary school book on what beavers do. And in some sense, really, there, you know, if you want to suck the joy out of learning about something, you go to the government manuals on it.
Do they kind of make them into a number, a statistic, rather than a living creature that's really wired complexly by the creator and does amazing things?
Yeah. So I mean, the idea is, and this is, you know, related to some of the stuff that's kind of the background information that's going into my post. I mean, as a philosopher, I actually studied philosophy of science. And one of the big take-home messages I got out of kind of investigating the nature of science, you know, not actually doing science, because again, philosophers, we don't like to get our hands dirty. We just kind of think about it. Is that there's a big difference between the models we have to describe our world and the world itself. Meaning that, you know, for instance, the beavers, if you're studying them, like a biologist is studying them, they might assign a fitness value, and I'll use evolutionary type language on that, like a fitness value. How fit are the beavers? Meaning, how many offspring do they release in any kind of given cycle? And these are all nice, you know. These are just ideal kind of figures, where the actual kind of individuality of the beaver is just forgotten in terms of generality. You know, this is like the atomic family has 2.5 children, this kind of stuff. And the sad part about it is that ideal doesn't actually map any given reality, meaning that it's what it is. It's a model, and the model fits or doesn't fit the facts, but when you actually look at the specifics, then you realize that your model rarely actually captures what is, you know, the specific events that are happening in, say, a beaver's life. And I thought this would be a good kind of message to try to draw up when we, as we're getting, you know, excited and learning more and figuring out what the kind of Lutheran approach to apologetics is. We got to be careful that we don't let our kind of models lose sight of the fact that we've got the people we're dealing with have serious needs and are real people, and that our models might not actually fit the people we're talking to.
That's a good way, I think, to summarize what your series here is doing, especially this first part, that when most of us, and myself included, go to talk to someone who's a non-believer and do so in an apologetic way, I'm not gonna enter in to the conversation as some professional apologist that we might see on YouTube or in person or on TV, something like that. That's kind of the point you're making here using the beavers.
Yeah, I mean, none of us, you know, the apologetic material right now. I mean, what's nice about us in terms of Lutherans kind of coming a little late to this conversation is there's a lot out there that's been done. And the amount of information at our fingertips is mind-boggling. I mean, I forget what I stated in the post. I think it was something like 2.5 million hits by just Googling apologetics. And that's, I mean, I can't fathom being like a new, my research was very much searching for books and topics where I get like 300, 400 hits. You know, here you type something in and you got 2.5 million pieces of information to kind of sift through and understand what the nature of apologetics is. What I saw in a lot of, and I didn't search all 2.5 million, obviously, or search them out, but what I saw in terms of the top hits tended to be this kind of more real formal, rigid debate structure. Know your facts. Know what you need to say at any given moment in terms of what your interlocutor, your discussion partner might respond with, and basically set out to kind of make sure you can win an argument. And when I thought about it, most of us don't really engage in life that way, meaning it's not a battle or it's not a win, lose, or draw type of scenario. It's more of, well, I'm having a conversation with somebody in the checkout line, or I'm at the water cooler at the office and, you know, my atheist friend is jiving fun at me for some of my Christian beliefs or something like that. Not that you could do that in the office these days, you'd probably get fired, but you know what I mean. I mean,
sure.
These kind of informal conversations that we tend to find ourselves in, those seem to be more, and I'm you know, I don't have necessarily firm data to back this up, but those seem to be the more real life situations we find ourselves in, not in a situation where we have to kind of go on the attack or defend in terms of the structures of formal debate.
Absolutely. You know, I was just on a plane flight last week, Dan, and guy next to me was interested in the book I was reading, and I'd placed it in the the little pouch on the seat in front of me. And he saw the title, Gnostic America. This is a book I was reading. And he says, hey, can I look at your book? And so I won't go into that, but just the point is, we started a conversation, and I had he was really kind of slamming Christianity and my book, as he read a little bit and then instantly turned to the back and looked at the conclusion. He was an attorney. And so I got a chance to apologetically talk to him. It was a quick flight, just probably about 20 minutes. And the point being, as your article so well points out, I could not enter into kind of formal debate technique with him, because he was directing the conversation. I wasn't.
Right.
I was just kind of listening to him, trying to be very careful about his objections, his concerns, and answer back. And you make the valid point, I believe, that that's more what most of us are going to get into. With apologetic technique. Maybe there's a listener out there, Dan, that is not in sync with us as to what we mean by apologetics. Can you quickly share what that is before we move on here?
Sure. Well, I view apologetics as, I think you've laid out in your kind of intros to the show. It's 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us. I define the hope that is within us as Christ crucified, death, resurrection, and forgiveness of sins. And I had to do a little searching on this, because this is, so the apologetic task, this whole Beaver post and this whole series, is me actually in a way just kind of getting my feet wet and thinking my way through this, hopefully for the better good of the laity and my other colleagues and things like this, as we try to kind of develop a Lutheran apologetic kind of methodology or something like that. But apologetics is in a sense the kind of formal defense of Christianity. And I think when you look at the actual kind of dictionary, the Oxford Dictionary defends it as a formal defense or justification of a claim. And our claim is specific, the claim found in 1 Peter 3:15, the hope that's within. And so I have a feeling that when we look at the apologetics in that sense as a formal defense, I think this has helped kind of spurn interest in thinking of it as a kind of formal speech and debate type issue, where we've got points and counterpoints and objectives and strategies it's very codified.
It's almost like I would say very threatening to the person that isn't deeply immersed in all that history and literature. Dan, would you say that the styles of apologetics that are normally called like classical apologetics and presuppositional apologetics? That's where I started to cut my teeth, and I found them to be very formal. I would not say they weren't fascinating or captivating intellectually to me. I very much enjoyed them, but I have to admit, I had a hard time applying those to the people that I wanted to make this apologia, this defense to the faith.
Right. That's a really good point, actually. And I don't do it in my blog post about discussing the difference between, say, a presuppositional apologetic versus an evidential apologetic or those kinds of nice categories. But there is an entire school of thought on apologetics that is presuppositionalist in nature, which just means that, the one way they talk about it is worldviews that are not Christian are they're parasitic on the Christian worldview. There's going to be inconsistencies in them. And the presuppositional apologetic is very good at pointing out the inconsistencies in someone else's kind of thought patterns. And the idea is that you break them down in terms of their entire kind of picture of the universe or something like that, or their entire philosophy of life. You break it down, show them that it can't survive on its own, and the hope then is that they will see that Christianity answers these problems that you've pointed out within their system.
And is it, would you go along with this, Dan, that with certain individuals or groups that you're maybe trying to do the apologetic task, let's say with an academic situation, to maybe go too casual would even offend them, if not turn them off, done in some ways. But so you might want to go a little more formally there. You know, I can see somebody like John Warwick Montgomery, Rod Rosenblatt, yourself, getting into it with heavy philosophy, with a philosophy professor or student. But for the majority of people, that's going to really be a non-connect. And so before we go on much more, tell us, apologetics hasn't, at least in recent decades, hasn't had a lot of interest, a lot of proponents among us Lutherans. And I, for one, just bemoan that. I can remember when I was one of the few guys that wanted to talk about it, you know, and read about it. So we Lutherans have kind of bumped up our game. We stepped up to the plate. And you know, I know that you and your group out there in Irvine, you are just so cherished by those of us that want to see apologetics increase among us Lutherans. Talk to us how you see that whole trending there among us Lutherans. You know, I think your article here on beavers can help us. It does help the case a whole lot more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the expert on the kind of history of apologetics or even all things synod. I mean, I'm the philosopher who went outside the kind of normal route to church work and studied out there in that secular university before coming home. But I can say that, you know, I think what really kind of tuned me in that the LCMS has turned a corner on this was actually, you know, when you were out here talking to us in that summer meeting, and you mentioned that you had run some extensive surveying of the local of the congregations within the synod, and it's the youth who are craving it and asking for it. And if there's any way to kind of, you know, motivate a kind of grassroots movement, it's got to come from our congregations. And I think because of the world we live in, and partly just because of the information, you know, superstructure we have, where you can find, you know, 2.5 million hits on apologetics in 0.15 seconds, I have a feeling that it, you know, it started turning some heads and saying, well, why don't we have anybody out there doing this? Why do I have to send my child to the Baptist church to get good apologetics? You know, because what else are they getting when they go to that Baptist church?
Yeah.
You know, and there's that kind of, you know, mentality that as a parent, I would, you know, be kind of nervous about. You know, why aren't we doing this?
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, that apologetics gets this view that it's all reasoning and logic, which, you know, Luther, you know, some would say incorrectly, I believe, that he, you know, condemned, but that's not true. Luther didn't condemn logic and reason. He just said you shouldn't use it in a state to be above Scripture, but to be a good helper. You know, an aid to the believer, the theologian.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, and the more I travel around and talk to the young people, Dan, I'm convinced of this. Even down to the middle high, school, a lot of these kids are you know, more advanced than I ever was at my age in worldviews, because it's so there in all the media for them. And so they have all this interest, and they hear these other views, and we need the Lutheran worldview, which is apologetics trying to do a whole lot. And before we go to the first break, let's introduce a little bit of kind of your thrust in this fine article. And by the way, you can look at this article, read it, and download it like I did. 1517legacy.com. I believe you have a search engine, or you can look under Daniel Dean, and you'll see this: Beaver's Help with Apologetics, Formal Debate, Jailbreak. So what do we need the jailbreak from? I like your phrase here. I remember reading it, and I was like, what's he saying, formal debate, jailbreak? And I was kind of onto it early, but I like putting formal debate and jailbreak together.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I'm not really. I mean, the titles for this article were kicked around, and I got a little help from the editor of 1517. I think you've interviewed him before, Mr. Ted Rosenblatt.
Sure.
With this one, and he's a bit more tech savvy and hip than I am. And the jailbreak here is a kind of new use of that term. Typically, jailbreak would be what we think about, you know, it's okay, so some convicts have gotten out of prison, okay. But here it's being used in that sense that, and the youth know more about this than I ever will, but this whole phenomena of smartphones. So you've got the iPhone, and the iPhone is programmed and actually designed in a certain way that it only works with Apple products. So very literally, it's tethered to Apple, and you can only run certain programs that the Apple iTunes Store, however this works, approves. The operating system, it can only run what Apple says it can run. And a lot of people, I mean, I guess maybe not a lot, but a lot of people, you know, they buy into it and they say, okay, that's great. I give up some of my freedom to use the Apple product in the way that Apple wants me to use it. And there's a lot of, you know, influence going on there. Certain people, though, say, I really like the iPhone, but let me see if I can get in there and actually play with the programming a bit to break it from the chain that kind of Apple has on it. And they call this process of kind of untethering these smartphones from their carriers and their operating systems jailbreaking. And I thought that was actually a very clever way to capture what we're talking about in terms of the article, because in the article we've got this kind of formal debate style of apologetics, this classical style that's very entrenched in the kind of history of apologetics and in the history of apologetic education. And in a way, I'm trying to offer a kind of a suggestion, so to speak, that we might be able to untether ourselves, not necessarily say it's unimportant, but untether ourselves from that kind of more formal classical model.
Yeah, and that picture, I think, works for so many of us, Dan, because, you know, a lot of us, whether we have the iPhone products or not, we're aware of them. They're, you know, enormous out there in the marketplace. And so, you know, if we can't get in there and do a jailbreak and free ourselves to use it in ways that Apple doesn't want to control us, that's kind of what happens in the apologetics world, I think, without maybe a conscious intent. But what most people see and read and hear is this formal debate style. And boy, I'll tell you, if I had to do apologetics from that, I would be at a loss because as you couch it, it is formal. And so the steps have to go in a good sequence. And I know sometimes when I try it, I just don't think that way. You know, I think in another way. And most of the time when I start chatting, as I was, you know, giving the example on the plane, a new friend, as I had, he's going to take me in directions that would take me totally out of that formal debate thing, you know, and you can't keep coming back to him, as some excellent debaters do, and say, hey, look, I never entered into it to talk about that area or in that sequence. And I go back to mine, you know, and
right.
And so I think that's the nice use of the phraseology that you have. So we're going to take a break here in a few seconds. And when we come back, Dan, I'd like for you to underscore some of the important points that you're suggesting from this phrase, apologetics, formal debate, jailbreak. I think these are going to be very helpful for all of us out there with apologetics. I, as I was preparing for the show today, you know, I relived that conversation I had on the plane with this attorney. And I was there. I didn't even know I was doing it, but I was there, Dan, jailbreaking from the formal debate style, and I was freewheeling it all over the place.
And there you go.
Yeah, and it was fun. I'm trying to get my engineer's attention. We're long due for a break. I don't know where he went. Just a moment. Here he comes. So we're going to have a few messages, and then we come back. We're going to let Professor Daniel Dean help us with jailbreaking from this formal debate prison that we're sometimes placed into. Stick with us when we come back. You're listening to Cross Defense.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our day's sponsor on this Monday, September 29th, 2014. Today's day sponsor is Michael Redman. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO in loving memory of his wife, Deborah, who went home to the Lord on this day in 1998. Once again, we say thank you to Michael Redman of Hillsboro, Missouri, today's Worldwide KFUO day sponsor.
Monday on Issues Etc., we're going to give away the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Galatians, to the listener with the best question or comment for Dr. Andrew Doss on the Book of Galatians. So tune in and call in Monday.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Hi, this is Vern Gunderman inviting you and your golf buddies to participate in Christian Friends of New Americans' second annual golf tournament. It's Wednesday, October 1st, at Quail Creek Golf Course. Funds raised help CFNA welcome refugees and new Americans in the name of Jesus Christ, as CFNA helps them establish a new life through Bible studies, tutoring, health screenings, citizenship, and ESL classes. It also provides scholarships so they can attend LCMS schools. Please join us. Information at cfna-stl.org.
Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service has been there for me since I began the American leg of my journey as a refugee. Their staff helped me and my family to a local church in the community where I resettled, a church whose hospitality could not have been more important in my transition to a welcoming American society. Learn more about Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and journeys like mine, lirs.org.
It just might be that you know someone who is aging gracefully but needs a bit of assistance. Perhaps you are looking for a doctor to make a house visit on your mom, or a handyman to fix an elderly neighbor's sink. Or maybe you think your dad qualifies for veterans benefits, but you just aren't sure. Aging Answers is a free service sponsored by Lutheran Senior Services. Make it your go-to source for aging-related concerns. LSS Aging Answers. 314-446-2475.
Hello, I'm Rod Zwanitzer, Director of Broadcast for KFUO. We totally depend on the gracious supporters who want this gospel voice to continue and expand as the messenger of good news of Christ. A wonderful part of this support is our underwriters, an ever-increasing number, and so we ask you to find out who they are by checking them out on our website or as you hear them here on KFUO. Write, call, or tell them how much you appreciate their support of Worldwide KFUO.
Have you ever thought about becoming a Worldwide KFUO Day sponsor? There are plenty of reasons to do so. Perhaps a birthday, an anniversary, celebration of a baptism, confirmation, graduation, any event. It's easy. Just call Mary or Joni at 1-800-844-0524. That's 800-844-0524 and become a Worldwide KFUO Day sponsor today.
Thanks for sticking with us here on Cross Defense, because we've got some great stuff to share with you. We're talking with Professor Dan Dean. He's written an article. It's actually the first of a series on Beavers Help with Apologetics, Formal Debate, Jailbreak. We're going to get into some of these things that we need to distance ourselves with for most of us. We're talking about formal debate here. I just want to read a little bit from this article because I think this is going to help you a whole lot. Dan writes, I've sat through enough presentations and watched a good number of YouTube discussions on apologetics to notice an alarming trend. The trend I've noticed is that of conversation management. Apologetics is standardly presented as something akin to a policy manual for beavers. We operate as if we are government agents of the Lord, mindlessly ticking off boxes in our manual. Boy, I like that. So this conversation management and freeing us, Dan, speak to us a little bit about that. I think that's a major component that is needed and in breaking with a formal debate, stranglehold.
Sure. So the idea behind that is that, when I watch various debates, and these are professionals, debating other professionals in their fields, rather beyond cosmological arguments, teleological arguments, intelligent design, young Earth versus old Earth creations, whatever the debate topic is that's got some apologetic import, I tend to notice that the sides will they'll polarize. What first tuned me off to this was the fact that certain questions would be asked and not answered because they sometimes wouldn't fit the form of debate at that moment. So I'm thinking of one in particular. There was a debate between William Craig and Christopher Hitchens I think it was before Hitchens died. I can't remember the date of it, but
I remember seeing that one. Yeah.
He did a couple of them, and I remember at one point during the question and answers, or whether it was during the response, Hitchens asked a question about Jesus, and Craig kind of the topic du jour I think was cosmological arguments, or does God need to be present? Does God need to be present for like the creation of universes or something like that? And William Lane Craig kind of pushed off an answer to that question because it wasn't part of the topic for the night. He went back to it in I think the informal question and answer with audience members later, but at least at that moment it wasn't. He deemed it not appropriate. And this kind of raised a flag in my head. Said, "Wow, that's interesting, because what apologetics should be about is getting to that hope. And if we define the hope that is within as Christ and His death and His resurrection, any opportunity I'm given to take a discussion or a conversation to Christ, I should do it. I should go. I need to go down that line. I need to go down that path, and have the conversation about who Christ was, what He did, and whatnot. Because it's through that proclamation, why I think you rightly said Lutherans sometimes get nervous about apologetics. It's through that proclamation of Christ's work that people respond or quote unquote become Christian. It's not going to be the result of some kind of intellectual exercise or argument." So this tuned me into the fact that a lot of the way we go about educating for apologetics is to set up the positions in such a way that we have a manual that we can kind of follow. If I'm having a debate about intelligent design, I go down this kind of 5-point checklist. And what's interesting about this kind of method of doing apologetics is the other side, the other, so to speak, the atheist, the new atheist, or whomever you're talking with, in the formal situations, they've done the same thing. They've got their own kind of debate manuals that they use with us, and it's really kind of created this non-conversation when we see it professionally done, because both sides are just kind of hitting their talking points, giving their kind of Twitter response justification, and then moving on to the next point. And me, as a philosopher, kind of observing this phenomena, and then thinking about, and also as an educator, thinking about, how do we educate youth and non-youth and anybody who's interested in becoming, more interested in apologetics. I started seeing how this could be damaging, because it almost presents apologetics as if it's too easy. As if there's you know, as long as I've got my book on 12 points of apologetic methodology, I can read that and I'm good to go. The problem is, as I was kind of discussing in the first part of our discussion with kind of my studies in philosophy of science with the models, is what we've done is we've kind of then created models of how apologetics ought to operate. And the problem with the model is we lose the individual. And because we're not all formal debaters, and we're dealing with the kind of individuals with a unique set of existential needs, and the primal need being the need for Christ, but we've got to get there by whatever means they're willing to give us. And that's where towards the end of the article I talk about how you lose the kind of beauty of the animal, this funny creature, the beaver. You lose the beauty of the beaver when you're reading the kind of government manuals, the statistical reports on what beavers are and what they do. And I fear, and I hope to be proven wrong on this, but I fear that sometimes we enter into the apologetic task as these kind of government agents that know what we need to do at what times we need to do, and we're more interested in just making sure that we can get our points across and manage the conversation versus allowing the conversation to flow and to deal with their issues that come up on their time and on their turf.
Share with us an example that you found that we can all go and look at, and I thought this was just so right on. Talk to us about Eastwooding.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't actually go watch the Republican National Convention where this took place originally, but apparently Eastwooding, Clint Eastwood, gave a talk where to the Republican National Convention where he had an empty chair that kind of was his discussion partner, and the empty chair stood for, I guess, the RNC or something like that. Again, I don't know how it works.
Yeah, it was the opponents, and so he was just mocking them, tearing them into without them being there.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I watched William Lane Craig do this because I was really excited about William Lane Craig debating Richard Dawkins. I thought that was going to be a great debate. I was surprised that Dawkins turned him down, and he and Richard Dawkins, they've had their kind of snafus in terms of, they're not necessarily the most civic with each other. But when I watched William Lane Craig do the Eastwooding Richard Dawkins, of course it was hilarious and it was fun and it was a great kind of promotional piece. Where you have the empty chair, which is Richard Dawkins, and William Lane Craig could carry out the conversation in terms of the way it would go as if Richard Dawkins were really there, and it would be interesting. I haven't done this, but to go see if we can find somebody who's actually debated Richard Dawkins that's of on the same question that William Lane Craig wanted to debate him on, and watch that debate, and then watch William Lane Craig's, and I bet they're going to be pretty darn close. In terms of the content and the argument and the moves that were being made between those two debates.
So Clint Eastwood kind of modeled, back to your use of that word, he kind of modeled for William Craig what to do when your opponent's not there. And to me and my apologetic experience, that's kind of what you do sometimes if you try to do it the formal debate way in apologetics. It's like talking to somebody that doesn't even exist. You're just steamrolling ahead, as you say, with a polarized position, and you're going to make their points no matter what the opponent says. And so I like what you're suggesting here that, most of us are never going to get into the kind of debates that William Lane Craig does, or these other fine debaters, and we must insist, as you do in your article, Dan, that you're not denigrating that, and you're not saying that has no place in apologetics nor usefulness. We all love to see those, but most of us are never going to be there, and so we need something else that's more conversational and allows us to be more creative and to take them to Christ. If I may, my conversation on this plane really exemplified that, because, as I said, this guy asked if he could look up my book on Gnosticism, and I said, sure. And so he's reading at the beginning, and then I see him, he flipped through the contents, and he looked a few pages, and then he instantly flips the conclusion, and he reads those three pages. And then his response to me was pretty interesting. He started out by saying, you know, this guy is basically doesn't know what he's doing. And I was like, wow, why do you say that? And he said, well, he's not doing academic fairness to it. And I came back to him and said, I don't think his target is to be academically sound here or on that level. His purpose is to show there's some tendencies out there in our country informally where this is used. And then he said, well, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, oh, wow, this is great. The conversation is going where I want it to go. And I laid on him, do you understand, you know, the big development of Gnosticism? It was about Jesus and about the creator God. And instantly went, wow, I know about the career thing. How about Jesus? And I'm like, wow, hey, it's easy. That's the thing that Christians are more concerned about is Jesus is incarnate. He's in a fleshly body. How can that be? And he's like, wow. And so I said to him, see where this guy's coming from then. How can somebody say they're a Christian and then go in this Gnostic sense that denies the incarnation and everything good about it? And he's like, wow, I never thought about that. And so we're having a great conversation, and he's not mad, I'm not mad, and I can tell I'm not convincing him yet, but we're having we're conversing about Christ and things that he wasn't aware of, and that was pretty neat. And so, you know, in helping us to be more conversational, Dan, we need to be pretty prepared, don't we?
Yeah. So, and again, so I'm glad you brought that up, that I'm not denigrating the formal method. The formal method is actually very important, and it's been very important through the history of apologetics. And it's really important for us as lay people in terms of just getting the kind of information that we need to be able to have informed conversations. So oftentimes, when we read these books, it's not that, oh, okay, well, this guy is kind of laying it out, kind of point, counterpoint, you know, I shouldn't listen to it. No, we need that information. But this is kind of, I call it it's like the educator's paradox. And it's not a real paradox because it's not something that we're contradicting, you know, there's no contradiction or anything like that, but it's just an oddity of the educational process. You know, we've got to get the information, but we've got to somehow be able to make the information our own and be able to use it in ways that the text itself or whatever it is we're learning about doesn't use it. And when I don't have the answers on how to be like a better conversationalist, but what I want to try to get out there, and as I'll work through the series of posts, is just maybe how can we begin just to listen to somebody else who doesn't have our beliefs, because the formal approach, we already kind of know, even if we don't necessarily ourselves, we already know that there's an answer to everything they're going to tell us, because it's in our formal kind of apologetic model somewhere. That what I'm advocating is that, you know, like your new friend on the plane, is that we sit down and we start the conversation where they're at. In a way, you know, for your listeners, another way to kind of see this, I used beavers, but I thought about using Tolkien. Because you've got the elves and you've got Frodo, and the elves know all there is to know about the ring, about how bad it is, but they're not the ones who can take it to Mordor. They sit in their high towers and they talk and they discuss it, and they've got all the lore and they've got all the information, but you've got to take the ring into the heart of the beast, so to speak. And I think for most of us, that's more adequate of the kind of way apologetic operates. We've got to take We're taking this ring. We're taking this, you know, I'll flip it a little bit because we've got Christ. You know, we're taking this good thing. We got to take it into the heart of the beast so that it can explode it from the inside out. Not that we prove the other person wrong, but that we work with the tools that they're going to give us to try to drive some kind of conversation toward Christ.
Absolutely. Now you talk about not only, jailbreaking in the sense that you use it here, becoming untethered from the formal debate ways and methodology and models to a more conversational one. And you say, I think importantly too, that you know, nobody likes to be managed. And so talk to us about how we all react if we think the person is not really concerned about us and they're trying to manage us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, no, I mean, I've got a little child, right? And I tell my kid no, and he immediately gets upset because he realizes that there's now limitations on the things that he can do. And oddly enough, the same thing happens in you know, maybe not ethical issues where I'm, you know, trying to train up my child in the godly ways. But when I'm talking to people, if I'm not willing to actually listen to what somebody else is presenting to me, because I've already built up a kind of response to what they're saying, then I'm not actually valuing that person as a person, nor their thoughts and you know, their kind of existential circumstance, where they are in this world. And once somebody kind of gets whiff of that you're not actually genuinely concerned about what they're saying, conversation tends to stop. At the root of kind of, you know, the apologetic enterprise is the goal of, if it's not going to happen today, I got to keep this conversation alive with this person. You know, at the risk, I mean, here's one way to think about it. You almost have to risk becoming friends with this person, right? The formal method kind of views them as an enemy or as an other that is there to be kind of tinkered with or argued against or destroyed, whereas the conversational method, if we take conversation seriously, you tend to start befriending the people you have genuine conversations with. And on this, I look to Christ and, you know, eating dinner with the sinners. You know, I go and I talk with these people, and you have to show them that you're genuinely interested in what their interests are.
And you know, when we really have the goal, which I always get in mind, is to introduce them to Jesus and all of his mercy and all of his richness and all of his glory. And you know, so I'm just not going to come out and say, I'm not important. I don't care about you. I don't care about what you think. I don't care about what your experiences are. All I care about is you and Jesus getting together. That doesn't show much concern for that person as well. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, I always like to think of it like they might think of me as a professional hired gun for Jesus, you know, and I'm looking at it as another mark on my gun that I got this guy or this gal. So that's really good because, you know, it allows us to let the person know that we genuinely care for them because we got a God who genuinely cares for them, and we want to sway it that way. And I like what you said there, Dan. I think that's so important. Keep the conversation going. So, you know, the formal debate style really, really, as you said it well, it polarizes out of the very beginning and says, nope, we're not going there. As you said it, we're not going there to Jesus. I've got to get the first three things ticked off my model here, and Jesus is later on. You know, mm-hmm. No, if you want to go there real quick, we'll go there. Mm-hmm. So I very much appreciate that. We're getting down, unfortunately, the end of the time on this first installment. Sure. on Beavers Help Us with Apologetics. Talk to us about maybe what we can expect in part two and those to come.
Yeah. So I'm just getting my feet wet. These are kind of exploratory posts in terms of understanding where, you know, how what I'm thinking in terms of apologetic conversation. One of the questions I do want to pursue, I don't know if it will be in the next one, but is what is the actual relationship between, say, apologetics and evangelism? Because I have a feeling that what I'm kind of tracking in terms of just becoming better conversationalists, it's a blurring of the lines of the kind of a classical distinction between evangelism and apologetics, with evangelism being just kind of proclaiming the gospel, and apologetics being the formal defense, when after you've proclaimed the gospel, you've got people asking questions about it. In a way, I'm trying to show that through conversation, you kind of you create an environment, so to speak, you know, to get back to the ecological language, an environment where the proclamation of the gospel is more effective. And I'm not sure that it happens. I'm not sure it's a 1-2 process in the way our formal models would tell us, first proclaim, then defend. I have a feeling that that the messiness of life itself, kind of these two categories are constantly kind of flip-flopping back and forth as you're having conversations with people. And so that's where I'm thinking of taking it. The idea with the beavers is going to be to return to the way I kind of end the post is a discussion of the classical naturalist. I mean, if you read like 19th century biologists, including Darwin himself, these guys, they loved the natural world, and they spent tons and tons of man hours just observing the oddest creatures out there and learning all about them in their actual environment. Today, the biologist, unless you're a field ecologist, tends to work from models, and you tend to just kind of learn wonderful things by creating kind of computer simulation experiments that you can run. And you've kind of lost a lot of the kind of, kind of modeling biologists have lost that sense of wonder at the actual natural world in terms of viewing the creatures in their natural habitat. And so my idea is to kind of take apologetics more down that classical naturalist route where you're dealing with people in the situations they're in and you're talking with them in terms of conversations and using the information, learning from them. There's a learning process to it, and it only comes through having multiple conversations and multiple engagements with these people. It's not the one-off kind of apologetic method where I've got one shot with this person, so I got to get everything out there quickly and now because I might never see them again.
Very much appreciate and encourage you on that, and especially when you talk about the blurring of the lines between evangelism and apologetics. I've become a real advocate of that, and if you haven't, maybe you have. Alistair McGrath has a great book on that I interviewed him on, Mirror Apologetics.
Okay.
So there's an archive on my interview with him about that, and he's really into that. And you listen to the interview, boy, he just keeps coming back to it, and I really liked it, where he talks about, too many people say, where's the dividing line? He said, there isn't really dividing lines, they run over each other, and I really appreciate that. So I think you're on the right track there, Dan. I've so appreciated having you on. And more than that, I really appreciate this article. I mean, you can't help but be attracted to an article's title. It says "Beavers Help with Apologetics." I'm all in. I got to read this, and so can't wait to get installment two and thereafter. And Professor Daniel Dean from Concordia University Irvine, teaching philosophy there. God's blessings as you minister to your students out there and your fine work at 1517 The Legacy Project, where we can go 1517legacy.com and check out this article, "Beavers Help with Apologetics." Dan, thank you so much. God's blessings. Say hi to all the great people there at 1517.
Will do. Thank you.
And we'll have you on again, Dan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.